This is KRCU's Going Public, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. I want to mention that today's show contains subject matter that some might find difficult to hear. We're talking about sexual assault. With high-profile cases like Brock Turner, the former Stanford swimmer who sexually assaulted an unconscious woman, the conversation of sexual assault has started back up on college campuses. Recently, Southeast hosted a forum for students and the community to talk more about this issue. I spoke with Molly Wilhelm, the Education and Community Impact Coordinator at Safe House for Women. Here's our conversation. Let's talk about sexual assault. Not too long ago, the university, along with KRCU, held the Sexual Assault on College Campuses event as part of their engagement series, and you served as the moderator for that event. So tell me a little bit about it.
Kind of the objective was just to start that conversation. Like, what is the university doing to not only prevent, but also help a survivor if something's reported? And I think a lot of education isn't necessarily out there. So it was a great time for Dr. Carter and Assistant Director Mayberry to tell the students and to tell the community what happens when a report is made on campus. And then we also saw on the other side of that, what that really looks like for the survivor. I was really happy with how it turned out.
So what defines sexual assault? Because as I learned, it's not just the actual act of having sex.
You know, there's a term called consensual sex, non-consensual sex. And to me, if it's consensual, it's just sex. If it's non-consensual, it's rape. It's sexual assault. But we tend to just think that it's the act, the sexual act, the unwanted forced sexual intercourse, when it can be sexual harassment, unwanted touching, unwanted advances, anything to where somebody is not consenting to the activity, whether it be sex, touching, whatever, then it's considered sexual assault. So anything where force is involved and not getting that free consent.
Well, something that I found interesting was, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, 1 in 4 women will experience some kind of sexual assault in their lifetime. But what really struck me was the idea that 1 in 6 men will experience sexual assault as well. Why don't we hear from them?
Well, I think we live in a country and in certain regions of the country where masculinity is defined by being strong and tough, and this wouldn't happen to me. And for some male victims, it's hard to come forward because then that so-called masculinity can be challenged. Like, you let that happen, you're a dude. Why did you let that happen? So we tend to look at men as these super strong, like nothing bad can happen to them, because I mean I think culturally, society wise we're kind of taught, if you look at traditional male and female roles, that men are strong and they're protectors and such, and that this stuff wouldn't happen to them. It wouldn't make sense. Why would that happen? So I think male victims don't talk about it because they don't want that stigma put on them. And so if nobody's talking about it, then nobody's going to talk about it, if that makes sense. So if no male survivors are coming forward and saying, you know what, this happened to me, it can happen to a man, then the others aren't going to come forward. I kind of look at when someone is accused of sexual assault, and then all of a sudden we have this windfall of other people accusing the same person. People are like, well, where were these people? They're afraid to come forward. So when one person comes forward, it makes it a little easier for other people to come forward. So I think if more male survivors talked about it, came forward, you would see a lot more of that 1 in 6, because that's a pretty high statistic.
Women face that same challenge of coming forward and reporting. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, I think with
or a lack of belief in
yes.
what they say.
Yes.
Why is that problem?
Sexual assault, and I said this on the panel, sexual assault, domestic violence, those are two of the only crimes that if somebody comes forward and says, this has happened to me, that we look for all the reasons why it happened to them that they brought upon themselves. Like I said earlier, if I go out and my car is stolen here, nobody's going to be like, gosh, you're so stupid. How'd you get your car stolen? Like, why would you park it there? You're, you know, whatever. They're going to think, okay, this girl's car is stolen. We have to get her help. We have to do that. Sexual assault and domestic violence aren't like that. Sexual assault, they immediately go to, well, what were you doing this evening? What were you doing? Oh, so you went out. Oh, okay. So were you drinking? Oh, well, how much did you have to drink? Oh, what were you wearing? You know, we tend to look at reasons to blame the victim. And I've worked with survivors for a lot of years, almost 10 years, and I still don't understand why we automatically do that. But we see it everywhere. We see it, you know, unfortunately, media plays a big part in that too, is looking at, well, what did they do to deserve that? Like, how'd you bring that upon yourself? And we don't ask that about any other crimes. So I think that keeps a lot of people from reporting, because if you report, they're going to investigate into your life, you know, which you're the victim. They shouldn't be. They're not going to, back to the car thing, they're not going to like investigate how long I've driven that car and did I have a car stolen before?
So like, for example, the amount of sexual partners
they
had.
Yes. They're going to look at, well, are you quote unquote promiscuous? Have you had several sexual partners? Have you had consensual sex with this person before? It's looking for a justification as to not call this a crime. And it doesn't matter how many times you've had sex, how many people you've had sex with. In the case of, you know, sexual assault within an intimate partner relationship, doesn't matter how many times you've had sex with that person. You know, everybody has a right to make the decisions on what happens to their bodies and when to say yes or to say no. And getting to that point, that shift, hopefully, will change maybe the way that things are investigated. And it's really not the fault of people investigating. We just have to make sure that we're not immediately going towards blaming the victim or trying to justify or validate why it happened.
Well, what should survivors or victims of assault, what should they do? Going back to that whole event that was just hosted, the women found it difficult to report it.
Well,
one of them did anyway, mm-hmm. until she was kind of forced into it by a friend.
Well, here's the thing. And here's the thing that's really, really hard for people that don't necessarily understand the nature and dynamics of this. Of these occurrences. It's really up. I can't say this is what you should do. I know what I think people that have been victimized should do. I think you should report it, or you should get yourself checked out, go to the hospital, do all those things. But not everybody's comfortable doing that. And everybody has a right to report or not report. It's whatever they're comfortable with. Because if we start telling victims and survivors, well, you have to do this, and then you have to do this, and then you have to do this. They've already lost the power and control over themselves. And so we're kind of just doing that again. We're kind of taking that again, like telling them what they should do. They have to make that decision, you know, and there will be people that never report.
And why is that? Why not report to get something done or make a record known so that in the event it happens to somebody else, mm-hmm. they have receipts, you know, they have
right,
a track record.
Right. You know, everybody's different. We have some people that if this were to happen to me, I would go and do this and this and this. But shame, you know, shame that this happened to them. It's a trauma. It's traumatic. Some people they're not mentally and emotionally capable of reporting. They are so traumatized that putting one foot in front of the other is hard after that. I mean, that's such a violation, such a just an invasive, horrible thing to happen that some people they're just not mentally and emotionally ready for that. And we have to respect that. We have to respect that everybody is in charge of their own lives and that they have to make the decisions that they want to. But I feel like the shame and then the scrutiny that comes along with it would keep people from doing it. You know, I always encourage, you know, if this happens, you know, you don't have to go and report it. That's not you don't have to do that. You are not required to do that. You don't owe that to anyone else. This is your story. This is what happened to you, and you have to own it. But I do always encourage talking to someone about it, you know, whether it be a counselor or an advocate of some sort, to deal with it, because the emotional scars, I mean, anybody that was at that panel last week, you could see it's so raw for those for those survivors. And it's raw. It's going to be raw for the rest of their lives. It's going to be right there on the surface. So I feel like, you know, we have to empower survivors to take charge of their own story and deal with it how they see fit. I know that I followed, you know, the Stanford case, the Brock Turner case. In his, the victim in that, she's really, over the past couple of months, kind of taken ownership of what happened to her. And she's been more public about it. I don't know if she's ever released her name, but she's really kind of come out of her shell. But and everybody,
it's different.
Yeah, and everybody's entitled to that. Like, I look at these people when they try to say, "Oh, that happened 30 years ago." Well, you know what? 30 years ago is a long time. You could be a different person than you were, and now you may be like, "You know what? I have to own this. I can finally confront this." And that's okay. That's okay. You know, we have to let people choose the trajectory of their own lives and their own stories.
Well, I want to move over to domestic violence, because these two things go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Whether you're in a married relationship or you're just partners, domestic violence happens for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it happen? How does it start? What are the warning signs?
Well, it's all, any form of victimization of another person, any form of abuse, is all about power and control. It's not about how somebody looks, how somebody acts, what they wear, whatever. It's all about power and control over someone else. And so, you know, I always talk about, we learn what we live. And I think sometimes people, there's no, like, gene in somebody's body that you can isolate that says they're going to be an abuser or they're going to be a victim. I think it's just their environmental issues. I feel like we kind of, like I said, you live what you learn, or learn what you live. And if you grow up in a household where there's good communication and there's ways to deal with conflict that are respectful, you're going to model that behavior as you get older. That's, you're going to look for mutually respectful relationships. However, if somebody grows up in a household where there's not good communication, where conflicts are resolved by screaming, yelling, abuse, if they see that happening, that does kind of change the course of your life, because you're going to think that that's normal. You're going to think that's a normal way of dealing with conflict, is to be abusive. So either you could seek out relationships where someone might treat you that way, or you may treat someone like that. So I think there's an environmental factor with that. I think insecurity plays a part in it. I mean, there's no real, it's power and control. It's people that want power and control over someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't start like that. I think you and I had this conversation the other day, that if somebody were to go out on a date with someone and the person was rude the whole time, made crass comments, was rude to the wait staff, was just a jerk the mm-hmm. whole time through, they're not going to go out on a second date. So these relationships don't start out bad. But over time, it's the little things. It's the emotional things, the name calling, the guilt tripping, the manipulation, you know, and it escalates further as it goes on. And the thing to really understand about domestic violence is the cycle of it. You know, there's the good period, and then it builds up to a bad time, whether it be physically or emotionally, sexually, whatever. And then it's followed up by a good time. So people end up being hooked into relationships and staying into those relationships, because it's human nature to focus on the good, not on the bad. And so, you know, those relationships kind of thrive in those environments.
So going with that, according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence in Missouri, 2012, 40,645 incidents of domestic violence were reported in Missouri alone.
Mm-hmm.
Does that number shock you?
No, because I'm in it. I see it every day. I think for people that maybe don't know as much about. It would be shocking. It should be shocking. It should be something that horrifies us and something that we're like, okay, yeah, this has to stop. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of instances that that's happening.
Well, what does this look like in Cape Girardeau? What does domestic violence look like here?
It looks like anything. I've seen most survivors that come to us have experienced emotional and physical abuse.
This is at Safe House.
Yes, at Safe House. They're experiencing emotional abuse. They're experiencing physical abuse. They're experiencing sexual abuse because sexual assault is used within a domestically violent relationship as just another tool for power and control. Stalking is also a part of that as well. So we see people come in that have been in relationships for a long period of time. They've put up with the abuse over years. Maybe they have children. They've waited. They finally leave the relationship. Or we see people where it's maybe the first or second time an incident has taken place and they try to leave. There's really no cookie cutter survivor situation. Every situation's different.
Now, when we talk about domestic violence, I want to go back again to the male perspective because it does happen to them. Actually, one in four men in the U.S. have experienced some type of physical mm-hmm. violence. What does an abusive woman look like? How would you know if you know, your sister, aunt, mother was abusive to their partner?
It's not necessarily, we're not necessarily seeing it physical, even though that happens. For sure, it happens to a male victim. But it's more that emotional, that control, that psychological, that degrading their male partner.
What do you mean?
Manipulating that, like the name calling, that you're so worthless, you couldn't be anybody without me. You know, that controlling where they go, who they see. They leave to go do something, they're blowing up the phone, they're, who are you with? You know, that those accusations, are you cheating? Or it's all of that, like, mental and emotional control over someone else. That's how we see it a lot. We do see physical too. It's the nature and dynamics of domestic violence is the same whether you're male or female. It's all about that power and control. And we again, it goes against our perception of what we think males and females should be based on stereotypes or traditional male and female roles. But that control can leave people feeling like, whether they're male or female, that they can't leave, that they're terrified of their victim. Maybe there's been threats made, or, you know, it has escalated to physical. We are seeing a lot more male victims come forward. I just think it's getting more talked about. It's less stigmatized. I think people are talking more about it on a national level, so they feel a little bit more comfortable. Or maybe they're like, somebody's in their life has said, you know what, that's not right what's happening to you. And just because you're a male doesn't make a difference. But it's harder. They have a harder road to go down because of perception. I don't know if you've ever seen that show, the What Would You Do show.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there was one episode where they had two actors, male and female, and they showed the male screaming, yelling, grabbing the female, like shaking her, and people like stepped in, like, this is not right.
Mm-hmm.
But then they reversed the situation, went to a different group and had the woman screaming, yelling, getting in the guy's face, you know, shaking him, pushing him, punching him. And people just kind of
walked away.
And it all goes back to that perception, like, oh, gosh, they're either thinking, well, what did he do to make her go so crazy? Or they laugh about it. They think, oh, that's just a girl. She can't do anything. But they don't know the mental and emotional part of that, why that man feels so victimized. So we have to get, as a society, we have to realize that, you know what, it happens to men too, and we need to take them seriously.
That's our show. A special thanks to my guest, Molly Wilhelm, the Education and Community Impact Coordinator at Safe House for Women. You can find our conversation on sexual assault and domestic violence on our website at krcu.org. or find us on iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join us next week for another edition of KRCU's Going Public.